Accession number 29702, Real 5.
Well, there's any weight and balance problem. And I took him to a hard stand. He talked to a crew chief for a little while, and I said, well, now, wouldn't you like to go to the club? No, he went, got back in his P-38 and took off. I think we did have problems, and as far as I was concerned, I really did prefer the earlier model. I prefer the B-24D, the one that I went over in, to some of the later models, because we had enough of a step characteristic in that airplane with that Davis wing. It was supposed to be a marvelous wing, and those of you who flew the B-24 will remember that. And one of the difficulties, when the airplane was heavily loaded at high altitude, you put on an inch of manifold pressure, and it gets up on the step and scoots along, and then you pull off just a little bit of throttle, and it mushes. And that made it very difficult to fly those aircraft at reasonably high altitudes with heavy loads and keep the formation in the shape that it was supposed to be. So I would answer your question by saying, really, I think that there were as many problems that those new turrets brought with them as there were solutions.
Any other observations on the B-24s as far as operational technique goes? Were there any changes in the way you went to war, in formations, or anything of that nature? Or were you operating more or less as you were in the early days?
I think we tried to operate pretty much the way we always had. But I do think that the thing was never a very well-balanced aircraft, or maybe it was a consequence of that wing, I'm not sure. But I don't think the addition of those turrets helped the aircraft a great deal. It undoubtedly added to its firepower. But I don't think it flew as well with those turrets as it did before the turrets came along.
Thank you. Jack Houston, would you care to give us your opinion of the later B-17s, the G model, which I know you flew in with the chin turret?
I think that chin turret was more psychological than it was in terms of effectiveness. But certainly it was a vast improvement over those two handheld 50 calibers out of either side of the nose. Again, I think that was maybe psychological also. I don't think there was any real success in terms of operating those. Also, remember, you had gunners who were much more skilled, and their main concern was, of course, gunnery, as opposed to those nose-operated guns, which were operated by the bombardier and or the navigator, who had other concerns and less talent, I think, along these lines. You didn't think I'd admit that, did you? No, I think this was one of the things then, Roger, that this was psychological. I think particularly with the chin turret, with the G model. But as you know, the F's and the G started to phase in really in May, June of 1944.
Thank you. I've heard it said by some B-17 pilots that the biggest improvement made in the aircraft during the whole of the time that it was operational with the 8th Air Force was the introduction of electrically operated turbo regulators as against the old hydraulic type which used to freeze. And that's very interesting. Anyway, let us move on. I think it's generally acknowledged that in the spring of 1944, the 8th Air Force escort fighters began to achieve a large measure of air superiority over Germany. Now, I'd like to ask General Gallen, to what does he attribute this? Obviously, a number of factors, but was it superior American tactics? Was it superior aircraft? Was it just numbers? Or was there anything else, sir, that contributed to this?
I believe it was a mix of all these different factors. And overall, the escort fighter flying the B-51 were changing their tactics from a pure defensive role to an offensive one. This is the biggest advantage a fighter can have. A fighter must attack. If a fighter waits and then he will be attacked, or if he wants to defend a bomber only by waiting until the attack comes in, then it is already too late. But bombers do not like aggressive fighters. They want to like the heavy fighters close as possible, and if possible, a little fighter on top of each wing. They asked us during the Battle of Britain, Goering blamed us for not taking care of the bombers, but running around in the air. We couldn't slow down to the bomber speed. If we would have done this, we would have been an easy target for Air Force. So we were swinging around the formation, and Goering tried to tell us we should change our tactics. And when I said we would be an easy target for the Royal Air Force fighters, and he said, I would prefer you would be shot down instead of my much more expensive bombers. And this made me angry, very angry. Going after 3 hours of blaming us for not performing the escort, finally said to my friend Mörders, what can I do to improve the fighting capacity of your wing? And Mörders said, I would like to have the more powerful DB605N engines. We're supercharged on that octane 100 fuel. And he going turned to his aide and said, take a note, he will get it. Then he asked me, and I had told him before that the Spitfire was a better airplane for escort because of their lower wing load, they had much more maneuverability. And Goering said, nonsense. You know, as I know, the Messerschmitt 109 is the best fighter of the world. So, what can I do for your wing? And I said, please, my Reichsmarschall, equip my wing with Spitfires. It was about 1 minute of silence. Then Goering turned back and stepped to his special plane, and I waited to be punished. I've never been punished, but I didn't get the Spitfires either. So back to the B-51s. I made this expression because I think one of the reasons for the big losses we got from 44 on was the change of the escort fighter from the defensive hull to an offensive hull. The next reason was the numerical superiority. We were never able to establish an equal number or to assemble an equal number in one place in one time. A third reason was that the B-51 were much superior in altitude compared to the Messerschmitt of different mass. So our industry had developed a special Mach for altitude, but this didn't work out, and we didn't have this in sufficient numbers. If you put all these factors and reason together, then you have the answer why the Luftwaffe suffered heavy losses and why the success against the protected bomber were, from our point of view, completely insufficient.
I must say a word in defense of the BF-109. It was a very fine aircraft, really, and in fact, in many ways, superior to the early Spitfires. However, going on... Oh, yes, of course you can.
I'd like to ask the general question because, of course, it's hard for me to avoid thinking about the way that we had cut back on their oil supplies. And I know that these Gallant guys, of which General Gallant was the commander, were terrific to start out with, but they had their losses naturally. And the thought that came to me, and it seems to be justified in what I've read about it, is that because of the shortage of fuel, they were not able to give their pilots coming on the pilot training they should have had. And I would like, General, for you to comment, if I'm correct in my thinking about it, when you put a guy up who's got 600 hours against a guy who's got 40 hours, it's really not a fair fight.
Thank you. That's absolutely right. We had a need to fill up our losses. We had a shortage of fuel. We had a shortage of pilot trainers, both aircraft and pilots. So we were forced to bring our young pilots into combat up from the middle of 44 with 50 or less hours in total. This cannot be, nobody can be responsible for this, only the situation. And I like to express that I have told Göring and Chief and Staff, nobody can tolerate this anymore. Because most of the pilots, the young pilots, didn't survive the third mission. Then he was killed, or was wounded, or was out of combat. And only the experienced pilots, which flew during the old war, they were clever enough to have success and to survive. Even so, I know pilots which still are alive with 80 more victories, which have bailed out 11 times and were wounded 30 times. They came back to combat every time. There was nobody who went back to pilot school or to the reserve or something else. We fought this fight without any reserve during the whole time.
I would like to ask General Gallen, I'm sorry to keep flooding him with questions, but it's just the way it comes along. The 8th Air Force started strafing German airfields in occupied territory in the spring of 1944. I'm wondering just what effect this had. Was it a nuisance value, or was it far more serious? Certainly it must have been towards the end of the war.
It was very effective, and especially when this was coordinated with timely coordinated with the takeoff time or with the landing for our aircraft in the spaces. Strafing was a very effective thing. But I could make the statement perhaps right now to shorten the discussion. We would have had some opportunities to stop the 8th Air Force during the day. The first opportunity we had in 44, before the invasion came, before D-Day, I had proposed and I got the permission to form a big fighter reserve. This fighter reserve were built through the fact that we didn't respond for days and weeks with bad or moderate weather. We did neglect the incursions. We didn't show up. So we had built up a tremendous force of about 2,000 fighters. And my intention was, on a clear day, to send up all of these 2,000 and fight them, fight the incoming bombers and fighters in one place, concentrated, and fight as you can fight. I have guaranteed for this case at least a loss of 304 engine bombers and perhaps 100 fighters. My correspondent own losses. This big throw, as we call it, did not come to execution because the invasion took place. But this big fighter reserve has only trained and built for the single purpose to fight against the four engine bombers. Hitler had thrown by his own order the whole force against into France and against the invasion. The effect was about zero, as you know. We couldn't compare with the numerical superiority. We didn't have the training. We didn't have the logistic support. The bases were damaged. So this big reserve has been burned up without any effect. Then, after France was more or less occupied, I got the second permission to build up a new fighter reserve by doing the same. And we were coming up to 1,500 fighters ready for combat. And then Hitler decided to make the last attempt with the offensive through the Ardennes. And on the 1st of January, I was dismissed at this time already under the command of our bomber inspector. The whole fighter force was sent over by leading bombers or observation planes as pathfinders in low-level flight against the Allied bases in France, North France, in Belgium, Holland. This was on the 1st of January, and the mission was called Bodenplatte. We lost about 380 planes, and 380 pilots, of course. Amongst these, 38 commanders, and the losses of the Allied side were high, but they were only material, mainly transport aircraft, so they could be substituted very soon. And the 1st of January was practically the end of the Luftwaffe, or at least of the fighter force. I'm sorry for being a little bit upset.
That's wonderful. It's what we want to hear. I must say, one does rather get the impression he didn't like his boss a lot, did he? Well, this leads the other way again. Richard, what was Groundstrafing like? I think it's a stupid question to ask you which you preferred, air fighting or ground fighting, because everyone knows that ground fighting was a risk business. But perhaps you'd like to comment upon the technique and what you personally thought about Groundstrafing. It's interesting to note that we have one of the 8th Air Force most successful Groundstrafers in the audience, so I expect that his ears will be open. Anyway, Richard.
Thank you. Scheduling a strafing mission to a given base always gave us fits if we were a known target, because the principal thing about strafing is you hit, you run, you do not go back again, or at least that was our philosophy. When you hit a base, you've got as low as possible, and that treetop is too high. Literally, your fence post high, because of the ground support. For example, Lechfeld, which is one of the more well-defended bases in Germany, which also is 262 base, immediately north of Augsburg, and it was, I always thought it was their right field, but I may not necessarily be right, but that was a heavily defended base. ACAC was all around in ground fire, and I'm not sure the size of the guns, but the quantity I was positive of. We always would try to pick a given direction where the number of guns that would be brought to bear on the traffic would also have in their line of fire their own buildings. So that meant that they would either have to hold fire or they would shoot up the place themselves. On a scheduled mission, though, I would rather have gone individually than with a scheduled group or several squadrons because of the conflict on timing. The first guy to hit that base is home free. The second guy maybe, but the second squadron maybe, but the last squadron on any concerted effort would be lucky to get through, literally, because of the screen of fire, not necessarily aiming at the airplanes, but setting up a screen of fire, especially with a liquid-cooled engine, like a 51 was, cause you to pucker a bit. They chewing grommets off parachutes, you know. But the B-47 pilots were probably better gifted at this, mainly because of equipment. They could take a hell of a lot of devastating fire as far as the engine and the power plant goes, and they could give out a lot with 850s rather than 6, but 6 was adequate. In order to counteract the ground fire, but primarily the concern was to make one pass and keep right on going. Cass.
That's an impossible order. We did a lot of work on dive bombing, of course, which is not the same thing, but we had a feeling that if certain techniques that we had developed in the use of a new dive bombing site were used by pilots strafing airfields, or in the particularly that Operation Chattanooga, which was trained, you know, in all kinds of surface vehicles, that the opportunity of coming away safely from it would have been greater than without it, but was never put to work.
One other item, Roger, just by way of random strafing by individual, either flights or pairs of pilots, was much more, I think, effective from the standpoint of transportation and locomotives. Besides, it was a lot more fun. Because of either the lack of return fire or the fact it was quite a display when the steam went up. But the idea was also in railroad yards. Sometimes we'd run across ACAC fire that were on camouflage boxcars or the sides would drop down, and we would end up with some return fire there. But mainly the strafing of airfields that were well defended. Cities were of no consequence. I mean, it was almost ridiculous to even consider shooting up cities. It didn't mean anything. The bombers are doing enough job there, but primarily airfields and railway stations or transportation that you'd catch it in the open field. I mean, a train running down the track, you shoot up the train so that it would block, the locomotive would be dead in the tracks and block transportation. Railway yards were always a good job. I remember the one particular instance I really enjoyed is near Leipzig, just on the outskirts, where a locomotive was coming from each direction. And I waited and I got a both in the film, too, in the end. Both coming from both directions and blocking both tracks.
There is a story about the B-51 pilot who, whose strafing or shooting wasn't too good. And it's perfectly true. And the CEO became a bit disgusted with this when everybody else was doing so well. And this character came back one day, and the CEO, the squadron CEO, said, "What did you get?" And the guy said, "Well, I killed a couple of cows. You look at my combat film, you'll see a couple of cows." So the CEO didn't take it as a joke. Sure enough, he killed a couple of cows. He made the guy go out and paint two cow symbols on the side of his P-51. Ground fire. The bomber boys may not have been having so much trouble from the Luftwaffe fighters, but the Luftwaffe's flak, the flak was part of the Luftwaffe, flak became something really dreaded by bomber men. I'm sure there are many people here who know that. I'd like to ask our two bomber boys, why do I keep calling them boys? They're older than I am. Gentlemen, the two bomber gentlemen, if they would like to make some observations on the increase in flak during the latter part of 1944 and early 45. Do they put the increasing losses to flak down to better radar control by the Luftwaffe controlling organizations down below, or just more guns? And what tactics were evolved to try and minimize the effect of flak, to avoid being shot down? We know, of course, that flak was claiming B-17s and B-24s until the last days of the war, but an awful lot went on to try and minimize the effects of flak. So can we have observations? And I'll start with the B-24 warrior. Philip, can you give us your views?
Yes, it was a very terrifying experience. You talk about us being bomber boys. Brings to mind that my friend General Ben LaValey hurt my feelings very deeply before we ever got started on this program by referring to me as an old fart. Now, if we're going to rule out all of theirs, we'll all have to walk out. But in any event, the question is, was the flak more effective as we went along? And I think it was. I think there's no doubt about it. And I think there was a paradox by which we were supposed to fly a tight formation in order to keep the best defense against the fighter planes, which General Gallen has talked about, the crossfire operation of the guns of one aircraft and another, but to fly that kind of a formation made the flak that much more effective. And it seemed to me that perhaps we might have employed a tactic where we didn't fly that sort of formation because the flak became so bad. Now, I think that not alone was the flak more effective, I think it was made more effective by the way we flew our missions. It seemed to me, and I think a lot of you guys who were flying those missions will agree with me, that the bomber command always routed the bomber chain over the heaviest flak. And you can take out your flak map, and you can see that we were directed right over the heaviest flak. And therefore, they knew that where we were coming and how we were coming. And they had their guns positioned perfect for the way we flew our missions. So I would say that their guns were more effective as time went on. I think we started out getting fired at by 88s mostly, and I think there were 105s and bigger guns later on. I think the newer guns, they said, in the gun carriages were more accurate than the ones that had been worn a little bit and were a little bit looser. But in any event, I have in my possession a nice collection of pieces of flak which I didn't bring with me today, but I'm sure would be amusing to those of you, particularly those of you who might also have such a collection of pieces that you picked out to remember certain raids.
Wouldn't you also say, Phil, that the fact was that, of course, our intentions were known. And I think Gerald Gallen will confirm this, that on the ground, the Germans then obviously knew that our success was predicated in part, of course, on that bomb pattern. And in order to get set up, to get that site, to get it stabilized, we then had that run in from the initial point. And they would plot us on the ground and knew that as soon as we turned in on that IP and opened those bomb bays, we were going to hold a straight and level formation. Back to Roger's question of what did we do, you didn't do a damn thing from the IP on in, except pray and pucker, I guess, is the other one. Pucker wasn't completely confined to the fighter, of course. But anyway, we didn't do anything. And the fact that this was then known to the Germans, DOC, and in terms of the use of their 88s and other guns, permitted them to concentrate in this area.